in a brand new perspective on the world and what's going on in the world around me. And I'm forever grateful for that. And I'm really grateful that my parents can be here tonight. That really means a lot to me. And I'm really grateful that I can be helpful and useful to others today. That's also one of the greatest gifts this program has given me. Tonight, I'm having my sponsor, Monica, speak for me. I knew I had to get a sponsor when I first came in, and when I met her, I remember I just thought she was drop-dead gorgeous, and I really liked her clothes and her shoes and her purse. But then I spoke to her, and she was so humble, and that always really sticks out in my mind. And I remember immediately after I met her, I knew I wanted what she had, and I didn't know anything about her. And we didn't have a conversation that was very long, but there was something really special about her, and I knew that I wanted her to take me on this journey. And she has been so remarkable, and I love her so much, and it's an absolute honor to have her a part of my life. So with that, I'll give you Monica.
Hi, I'm Monica. I'm an alcoholic. My ego is like that big from what she just said right now. Hang on. All right, shake it off. All right. Just garden variety drunk. Okay. So, my sobriety date is June 13th, 2005. I have a home group. It is this group, and this is my home group because this is where I feel at home. So, it just makes sense to me that way. I have a sponsor. She is fabulous. She's babysitting in the back there, and I've had the opportunity to sponsor Rachel for the past year, and that's the biggest gift I've had in the past year. And as much as I tease her about how much of a pain that may be, or tease her about trying to claim that she has, like, study groups on Friday nights when she doesn't want to go to a pigeon meeting, or different things that she doesn't want to do, when it comes down to it, I'm very, very grateful to have her in my life because she allowed me the opportunity to work the steps with her and take her through the steps. And I don't know that I can really say that I've worked my 12th step without having taken somebody else through the steps. So that's been a really, really cool thing for me. And the fact that she's stuck around, that's just really cool for me too. This is the first time I've sponsored a girl that's gotten a year, so I'm like, yay. It's nothing to do with me, but I'm still excited about it. I'll tell you a little bit about where I came from. I'll tell you about me drinking, because if people didn't talk to me about drinking when I came to AA, I wouldn't have related to them. So I'm going to tell you how you can relate to me. Or if you choose to, how I can't. If you want to pick out differences, I'm sure you can do that. I know I did that for a long time in meetings, but I try to look for the similarities today. The similarities that I find here are that people felt like I felt growing up. They felt a little different. They felt a little out of place, and I know that was true for me. I was born into a really, really large Cuban Catholic Sicilian family, and I was the baby of it. So I always got whatever I still get whatever attention I want from my family. I was very spoiled growing up, and in a good way. You know, they were really good parents. They were nice parents, you know. They did what they believed was right at every turn, and I'm still an alcoholic. And I grew up with an older brother and an older sister that both excelled a lot in their own right. You know, like, my sister's really funny, and she's really outgoing, and, you know, she could care less about makeup or anything. She's very comfortable in her own skin, and my brother's brilliant. And then there was me, who didn't really know what was going on, and where I was supposed to fit and what I was supposed to do. And I was incredibly, incredibly selfish at a very young age. And I've learned that more recently just from stories that, like, my parents like to tell me about, things they like to remind me about. The longer I stay sober, the funnier they think that is. You know, they think, oh, you think it's funny to tell us about you drinking. We're going to tell you about you being obnoxious. So they do, and it helps. It keeps me much more humble than I probably would be otherwise. So I know that I was very, very selfish and self-centered. I used to threaten to run away all the time and then remember that, like, Christmas was coming and I was going to get presents. So I couldn't leave because I'm not going to say no to all these presents that are coming. So I'd stick around until Christmas, and then I'd go to run away again, and then my birthday was coming, so I'd stick around so I could get presents. And this was the way that my brain worked. It was all about what do I want. And I don't know when my first drink was. I know that there are photos of me drinking when I was like 3, so I imagine sometime in that and there. Alcoholism wasn't something that was discussed in my home. Nobody in my family that I'm aware of is an alcoholic. None of them have said it out loud anyways. Certainly none of them come here. And most of them find it pretty comical that I do. They, like me, thought that there was a very specific kind of person that was supposed to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't match it. And that's how I was able to identify out of you guys as much as possible when I was first walking into these rooms. You know, if you didn't look exactly like me, tell my exact story, talk exactly like me, drink my favorite kind of liquor, or whatever, then you can't relate to me, you can't help me. And that's just not the case. That's not been what I found here. Anyway. So, I don't know when my first drink was. I do know when my first drunk was, and I loved it. I was in high school, and I went to a concert with a bunch of older people, because that's what I thought the cool kids do. You know, you make friends with the older people, and they can buy you what you want. Again, I'm doing what I want right now. And I knew that I didn't have a fake ID like everybody else did, so I had to do what any good alcoholic does and steal from her parents. So, I went, and I got a big Zephyr Hills water bottle and filled it up with my dad's vodka and took that with me to the show and ready to go. And there's just nothing quite as nasty as warm vodka in a dancing 100-pound 15-year-old. Like, it's just, it was bad. It was bad, bad, bad. But I loved it. You know, I spent most of that night puking and the entire next day getting wildly sick. But I didn't care because it was fun, you know. It was fun before the puking started or in between waves of nausea. It was fun. You know, I was dancing with these people and I had these friends that I didn't have outside of that. You know, I had these girls that I was deathly afraid of and completely intimidated by, wanting to be my friend now. Or at least I didn't care what they were saying about me behind my back when I'm hammered. I don't care about your opinion anymore. And I liked that. I liked the fact that I didn't have to care about what you thought anymore. So that's what I continued to do. I did drugs for a while. I went through different phases of different drugs, and that was fun, too. I just, whatever the feeling that I was searching for in that moment was, that's what I went after. Whether that is a new boyfriend, whether that's getting drunk, whether that's whatever, that's what I do. Usually it came along with getting drunk and then something else, too. And yes, shopping, shopping, shopping. I do like to shop. I'm getting faces from the girls in the front row. But in all that time, I went through high school doing what I thought normal high school kids do. You know, I thought that you steal liquor from your parents, you go to parties, you go to keg parties, you puke, and it happens, and you grow up. And I had this theory that if I did everything before I turned 18, it wouldn't matter. Because it doesn't really go on your record if you, like, get arrested or anything. And people really aren't going to forget when you're, or they're not going to remember when you're an adult. They're not really going to remember what you did in high school. So who cares? So I'm going to get it all out of my system now. And that was a good plan until I turned 18 and didn't stop doing anything that I was doing. It just got worse. So I managed to get into college, and I went to a college nearby and pretty much did the same thing. I promptly got kicked out of my sorority for getting a bunch of the pledges drunk and high, which you're not supposed to do. And if you do do it, you're supposed to tell on them, which I did not do that either, because I didn't want to be a rat. And so I got kicked out of my sorority, and all these things that I was trying to make up about me to make sure that everybody else knew that I was okay weren't working anymore. You know, I'd been able to pull off, like, maneuvering a nice car out of my parents, so that was good. You know, that was a good show. And I could blow dry my hair and put some makeup on and, you know, look halfway decent, which I really didn't, but I thought I did at the time. So, okay, that looks good. And I can get a job, and okay, that's good. And I can join the good girl dry sorority for God knows what reason, because that's good. And I couldn't pull it off anymore, and people started to notice. And more importantly, my family started to notice, and these happy, nice people didn't know what in the world to do with me, so they brought me home, and they thought, you know, this is the God will help you, or will help you, or whatever, and they brought me home. And what happened when I came home was I had a job, like I said, and so I had money coming in, but I was living with my parents, so I didn't have any money going out, and it was just fun, you know. I had a really good time for a long time, and then I started to go crazy. Oh, I started to acknowledge that I was crazy. Anyways, I think people thought I was crazy way, way before that. But I started to not sleep really ever. I started to go to these really nasty little hole-in-the-wall bars that I had always made fun of people for going to because I loved them. You know, these are my people now. But it was really cool that bartenders knew me by name. I thought that was really, really, really cool. I thought it was great that I could go to Ybor and people knew me by name. These are my claims to fame. You know, these bartenders know me. Yes. And it was gross. So one of those days I was on my way to my job, and for God knows what reason, I decided that I was going to take off. And this is in like Monica fashion. If something is not going my way, I'm either going to completely whine and moan and pout and do all those kinds of things until I get my way, or I'm just going to leave. And I'm going to find somebody else that's going to give it to me my way. And that's something that Alcoholics Anonymous has had a lot of time to work on now, and it's getting better. And but at that time, it was, I need to get my car and I need to go. And that's what I did. I got my car and I left. Because I didn't have, like Jamie was talking about, I didn't have anybody anymore. You know, I didn't have that person that I could call and say, hey, what's going on? You know, all I had were the people that were angry with me for having stolen something, having not paid somebody back for something, having vomited in somebody's car, having slept with somebody's boyfriend, or one of the above, you know. These were the kinds of people that I was around. So nobody wants to take my call. Nobody wants to talk to me. Nobody wants to help. Because most of the people around me have come to terms with the fact that I am beyond help. So they cut me out. Like good, smart people do, they cut people like me out. And so I got in that car and I took that trip. And the first week or so, I had a blast because, you know, I'm free. I don't know what I was breaking free of. I was breaking free of people that cared. But I'm free. I'm going to take off and it's going to be great. And I'm going to start my new life somewhere. And I watched like a lot of Law and Order and like crime shows. So I had these really grand plans of how I was going to get my life restarted. And, you know, how I was going to makeshift this ID and use that. And it was insane. But I had this great plan of how I was going to do that. And somewhere about, I think it was like Missouri. I think it was Missouri. Anyway, somewhere around Missouri, I don't know really geography very well, but somewhere around that area, I realized that it just sucked. You know, I had dismantled my phone because I didn't want them to track me. And I had tried to dye my hair because I was convinced that they were all after me. And they thought I was in Tallahassee and I'm in, like, rural America. But I was doing all these things to make myself not myself so I could restart, you know, that fresh start. I'm going to have a fresh start somewhere and I'm gonna do this thing. And I didn't. You know, I kept showing up and people kept staring at me, which is probably because I weighed like 45 pounds and I had these horizontal stripes in my hair and I was just nasty. So that's probably why they were looking. But I was convinced they were looking because I was on America's Most Wanted and my family was trying to find me. I was really, really paranoid. So I would just go into like little bitty hole in the wall bars along the way and drink with strangers. And at the time I was 21 and like I said, real skinny, and but I thought I was really good looking. So I would go into bars and like try and like flirt my way with these nasty people. It was so gross. But this was my idea of fun. This is what I was doing, you know? And that was okay with me. It didn't bother me that I was going to be in cars or homes or bars with people that I was deathly afraid of, because I wasn't afraid anymore. Because we're getting drunk together. We have a bond. We're friends. You know, he's honest. He weighed that bag. You know, like, that was my idea of safety. And that stopped being okay for me. You know, I'm not comfortable in that anymore. And somewhere along that trip, I stopped being comfortable in that. And I ended up, a very, very long story, very, very shortened down, I was locked in a basement for a couple of days. And that's what happens when a little girl goes off into rural America by herself and decides to tell people that she's in rural America by herself and nobody knows where she is or is expecting her to come home. People lock you in basements. So they do. I should have known that from Law and Order. So when I was on that trip, I decided, you know, a lot of things happened, and while I was gone, I just started to have this overwhelming feeling of, I want to live. I don't like this. I don't want it this way. This hurts. This sucks. This is painful. This is going to kill me, but I don't want to die like this, you know? And for years leading up to that point, I was completely okay with kill me now. Wherever, whenever, I could care less if I wake up. It will be their problem to clean up the mess. I don't care. And for whatever reason, in that day, something switched, and I wanted to live. And I was deathly afraid because I didn't know how anymore. Or I don't know if I ever had to begin with. So I made a call when I was up in Wisconsin, right by Canada, and I made a call from there and called my parents and told them that I was going to come home, and of course they didn't believe me, where would they? And what I found out was that 3 weeks that I had been missing, they thought that I had been kidnapped. Because I usually apparently had tells when I would just like run away for the weekend, and unfortunately this time I didn't give them any of the tells, so they thought that I had been kidnapped. And so I was on some like show and some missing persons thing, and there were flyers everywhere, and it was really horrific. It was a really horrible thing that I did to my family, because my poor mother, like I said, this nice lady who tried to raise a good girl, is crying over her daughter that she's convinced has been raped and is beaten in the street somewhere. And for 3 weeks I let her live in that. And by the time I came home, it was pretty clear that it was time for me to get some help. And so I asked to please be put into some kind of mental health facility. And so they put me into rehab, because they all knew that that's what I needed. And they, I guess, had discussed it while I was away. So a couple of days later, I got checked into a treatment facility over in Clearwater. And in the first couple of days of that, I had no idea I was in rehab. I had no idea. It was very fancy. Like, I've gone to speak in other treatment centers, and they don't look like this. And this place had, like, a pool and chefs, and it was fancy. And, like, I've been eating ramen noodles for, like, 3 years up to this point, so I was really excited that they made homemade cinnamon buns. And so they could have kept me there as long as they wanted, just on that. But for the first month, you know, they did, they took us on that little, you know, the little white bus, and they took us to meetings, and that was weird, because everybody kind of stared at me, and it was summertime, and I was in flannel, because all of the clothes I brought were highly inappropriate, so they took them all away. So I was in pajama pants. Oh, and when I was in treatment, I found out that I had a tumor, so I couldn't really stand up all that straight. I was kind of hunched, like that, and I would walk around with a heating pad that I'd have to, like, plug in the meeting, and if you were by the outlet, I had to move you so I could plug in for the meeting. Fun. That's why I don't think cramps are an excuse not to go to a meeting. Not. Sorry. But anyways. But that's what they told me. They told me you get up and you go to the meeting. Like, we don't really care if it hurts. You're going. That's what's going to happen. And then they'd bring meetings in on the weekends, and there's really no way of getting out of a meeting that they're bringing into the house that you live in. You have to go. So I went. And this guy started talking, and he started telling my story. You know, he started talking about these feelings that he had, and he started talking about how he didn't think it was possible for him to have this problem because he was too young, and he started saying these things that I was like, yeah, because old people, they don't get it. That's what I'm right there with you, you know, like that's what it is. That's that creepy feeling I have. And he explained to me what that was. And so I asked him what meeting he went to, and promptly went to that meeting when I got out of treatment. So I'm really grateful for that treatment center, because they gave me a chance to sober up long enough to hear something. They took me to meetings, and they allowed people to come in and bring meetings there. And I'm sure they did some other good things. I just don't remember what they were. So these are the things that I'm excited about that treatment center. So after that, I went into, like, a halfway house. Again, a fancy version of one, because I don't know any better. And I went to meetings pretty much nonstop. Like I said, I was a hot mess when I got here, so I wasn't very employable at all. You know, nobody wants to hire the girl with stripy hair who can't stand up straight and who's crying everywhere. And I did not stop crying for 6 straight months at all. So I couldn't get a job, but that was great because I got to go to meetings all the time. That's all I did. Morning, noon, and night, I went to a meeting. I was constantly on the phone with my sponsor. I followed her around like a puppy because I didn't have any other friends. And my sponsor at that time was Lola. She was this really, really large black woman who scared me to death. And that's why I got her, because I had been surrounded by and I had surrounded myself with people who would give me whatever I wanted at any moment. And I needed somebody who was going to tell me the truth when it hurt. I needed somebody who wasn't going to give me what I wanted, who was going to give me what I needed. And what I needed to do was start working the steps. And that's what she did. She gave me a book. And she told me to read We Agnostics, and I told her I was Catholic and I didn't need to. And she didn't care. And she told me to read it anyways. So I did. And I still thought it was weird. And that's fine, you know, because I kept going anyways. I didn't have to like everything that I did. I didn't have to enjoy everything that I did. I just had to do it anyways. I didn't like everything I did while I was drinking. I didn't like most of what I did while I was drinking, but I did it anyways. And for me, that is a very clear line of logic. If I will do it to get drunk, I damn well better be able to do it to get sober. So that made sense to me. And, you know, at about a year and a half, I went through something that I think a lot of us go through, which is I knew more than my sponsor. I was highly resentful at the group. I felt like, thank you very much for your help, but I got this now, and I'm out. You know, I'm done. I've been made better. You fixed me. I've been sober a year. Yay. And I told my sponsor about it, and she was like, okay, well, then why don't you go back out? Like, stop coming. We don't need you here. Like, go. And that scared me to death. You know, I expected something very different. I expected a plea for me to stay. Please, we need you. You know, who's going to clean the cigarette butts? And all these things that went through my head that she just didn't say. And she told me it was perfectly okay for me to leave. She wasn't making me stay. If I wanted to drink, I could drink. If I wanted to go do drugs, I could do that. That's fine, go. And by the grace of God, for the following 3 weeks, I didn't get drunk or do drugs, but I did everything else self-destructive I could think of, because that's who I am. I'm self-destructive. You can give me opportunity after opportunity, and I'm going to throw it away every time. And so that's what I did. You know, it was quick. It was dropping out of school, losing my job, everything all, you know, the same thing all at the same time. And everything just started to suck all over again. And my mom came over and started drug testing me again, because she likes to do that, just in case. And started drug testing me again, and she's like, oh, shit. Oh, no. Sorry. And she realized that her crazy daughter was back, but there was no drugs and there was no alcohol in my system, so where did this crazy girl come from? And she was afraid. And she told me to get to a meeting. And she had never done that before. You know, my first year and a half sober, all I had been told was, are you done yet? When do you graduate? When is AA over? When do you get to stop doing this? When do you get to be a normal person? When can you just have a drink? And these were honest questions that these people had. They didn't know any better, and that's okay. You know, I used to resent them a lot for asking me these kinds of questions, but it's not their fault. They're not alcoholics. They don't know that I can't do that. And if I can't do that, it's my responsibility to tell them I can't do that. So After that time, she realized that it wasn't the being sober part that had changed her daughter. It was the working a program and practicing spiritual principles that was changing her daughter, and she wanted the new one back. She did not like this crazy person. So I got roundabout invited to come to Tampa Bay Young People's Group. And I came, and when I got here, I think I told most of the people here that I was not an alcoholic, I was a drug addict, because I was much more comfortable saying that I was a drug addict than an alcoholic. Drug addicts, in my head, meant that I will be able to drink again safely at some point. Alcoholic does not. Simple. It was very, very simple. So I thought it would be a better idea to be a drug addict, so I was. Or that's what I called it. And so when I got here, I thought that was very strange. And then all these girls that I didn't know were coming up and super excited and just loving life and talking to me. And it was very creepy. And it caught me really off guard. And I've always dealt with really mean girls. And I've always been a pretty mean girl. So it was very strange to have all these really friendly people around. Oh, I forgot to mention that my old home group, that's why. My old home group was, it was called Freedom Recovery in the Hood. And, yes. And I'm not trying to be cool. It's called Duh Hood. That's the name. And it was a great way for me to make sure that I could feel different from you at any given moment. I could close my eyes and I could relate to you, but the minute I opened my eyes, I could see how different we all were. You know, I was in a room with primarily 50 and 60-year-old black men and me. So, yes, we looked different. When I got that super resentment, one of my things was, I'm too young for this. It's not possible. It is just not possible. You guys tricked me. I wasn't even 22. Everybody's like that. No, they're not. But everybody's like that. And so when I walked in here, it felt like I was being punched in the gut with young people need to get sober too. You know, like young people can have this problem too. And a lot of the people that are in your head, like the stereotype that I had, wasn't quite right. This was where I needed to be. This was where my home was. And so I promptly tried to make it that way. You know, I tried to show up for as much as I could, and I flaked out on a lot of stuff. Definitely true. But over the past, it's almost 3 years that I've been part of this group now, and that's really, really cool to me. Because there are people in this room that I can tell you right now, there is no way in hell we would be friends outside of this place. But because we're here, like Dave. Dave helps me every single week with the coffee. When I flake out and can't make it to my commitment, Dave shows up and he does it for me. Now, I don't think Dave and I would be hanging if we had not met in AA. But it works. It's nice, you know? He's laughing. He knows it's true. He would probably hate me. But it works, you know, because there are people in these meetings who are willing to help me stay sober. They're willing to show me what they had to do to stay sober, and it goes above and beyond all of the rest of that stuff. It goes above and beyond what I look like. It goes above and beyond, you know, where I go to school or who I talk to and who I hang out with. If one alcoholic is helping another, I'm going to get better, regardless of which of those alcoholics I am. You know, I know that for me, I have to believe in my first step every day. I have to know that I'm powerless over alcohol. I have to know that without God in my life is unmanageable. And God has shown that to me at every turn. Without Him in my life, I am highly, highly, highly unmanageable. And I have really great people in my life who are willing to show me that today. You know, there's some great women in this room, and also some great men, too, that are willing to tell me when I'm out of line. And that's one of the most important things for me today. You know, I'm an alcoholic, so I'm not going to do anything right all the time. I like to think that I do. You know, ask poor Ryan. I say I do everything right all the time, but I don't. And this is one of those things that I don't do right all of the time, but I have people that will show me how to make it better and show me how to do it better next time and show me that even if I mess it up this time, I don't have to drink about it. And that's the most important thing for me today. You know, I hear a lot of us going around, and I've certainly been guilty of it too, and, you know, we tell each other to do these completely arbitrary things. And, you know, one girl was getting yelled at to read in a meeting the other day. And I said, it was ridiculous. The girl stayed sober that day. Like, does it really matter if she reads all that much? No, probably not. You know, I think for myself, a lot of times I get really, like, messed up with all these ideas of it should be this way, it should be this way, it should be this way. And I forget the fact that as long as I didn't drink today, it's a pretty damn good day. You know? I do want to become a better person. I do want to be happy, joyous, and free. I do want to be useful to God and to my fellows. But I can't do any of that until I don't drink today. And that really is sometimes the bottom line. You know, what can I do on top of that? Great, let's do it. But that's got to be my first thing. And that's also why I have to put my program first. You know, I'm not going to take a stance on the whole relationship thing. I'm just not going to go there with you guys. But I think that any of these things, anything that these normal people can do, these normal lifestyles or whatever that people have, we can do if we put our programs first. In my experience, that's been the case. You know, I've been given the opportunity to get a job and to go to school and hang out with my family and that kind of stuff. Not because AA said, here's your tip and here's your job. It doesn't work that way. You know, AA said, here's how you don't drink today and here's how you become a better person. And that's when that other stuff started to come true. And I'm really very grateful for that. Not in a way I can put into words for you guys, because you guys know that's nonsense, but I'll stay and pick up the chairs, you know, and that'll be my thank you. So thank you very much, Rachel. Rachel's been awesome. Thank you.
Amanda, I'm an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is and we understand what service is. So let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get to the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.